DW Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome. I'm Nick Martin in Germany. On today's programme, as Ursula von der Leyen is handed a second term as European Commission Chief, can she unite the bloc? Russia's migration weapon and how the Finnish government plans to turn back refugees at the border.
It is a strong message to Russia. Finland takes care of its own security and we ensure the security of the EU border.
Don't mention the war, how ordinary Russians are growing wary about the Ukraine conflict.
People feel that it makes no sense to discuss even the future of this war because nobody knows when the war will be over and it really scares a lot of people.
And green activists fail to block a new lithium mine in Serbia. Those stories and more coming up on the programme. Just as we're wrapping up production for this week's show, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen has just been given a second term at the helm of the EU's powerful executive arm.
I will never let the extreme polarization of our societies become accepted. I will never accept that demagogues and extremists destroy our European way of life. And I stand here today ready to lead the fight with all the democratic forces in this House.
The former German defence minister received the support of the majority of lawmakers in the European Parliament in Strasbourg. She was nominated by the bloc's 27 leaders last month and has since tried to build a broad coalition of support in the EU legislature to fend off a surge to far-right parties during the European elections in June. For more on what a new five-year term for von der Leyen will look like, I spoke to DW's Brussels correspondent Jack Parrock.
Well, it was stronger than last time. That's the significant announcement here. She got 401 votes out of the, well, it was 361 that she needed. So she has a big mandate. Last time she only scraped through by 9 votes. It also is a sort of badge of honour that what she managed to do was to get around these MPs. For the last few weeks, she's been locked into discussions, working out what they want, what she can offer them, and what she can get off them, which is their votes. And she succeeded. Politics is often just a numbers game.
Now, von der Leyen made her pitch to the European Parliament this morning, detailing her plans for a second term. What will be her priorities?
It was really interesting to hear what she had to say. She sort of tried to cover all the bases. The overarching thing that she's promising is a much bigger focus in the Commission on security and defence. She's proposing to put forward an EU commissioner for defence. She's saying she's going to increase the EU's border guard Frontex by 3 times to get around 30,000 officers. She's also looking at potentially getting a European air defence. There are lots of promises that she made, including a defence fund for the EU. Whether she can get those approved in the next 5 years as Commission President is another thing. But it's clear she was making that play towards the harder right factions of conservative politicians in the European Parliament. She also worked to the socialists, though. She said there's going to be a housing commissioner of the European Union, not really an EU competency. Housing is normally done by the governments of EU member states. But that's something that the socialists care about. So she did that to try and win their vote. And she also has proposed a commissioner for the Mediterranean region. That's something that the hard-right Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni wanted. So she was courting votes from the even more conservative European conservative and reformist group that she could have scraped a couple of votes into that total to get her over the line. She really was playing the game and making all of these offers to try and get those votes.
And do you think those right and far right parties that surged in several EU countries during the election, will they be satisfied with the influence that they've been able to have in this process?
Probably not. We knew that there, as a party, they wouldn't vote for her. It's important to say that this was a secret ballot, so potentially some far-right MEPs could have voted for her, but that wasn't along their political party line. But she didn't need them. She knew that she had to work towards the centrist factions, and she's managed to do that. One of the real standout things in what we heard from her is a real shift on environmental policy. She says that within the first 100 days of her next commission presidency, she'll announce a Clean Industrial Act. Now, that is a very different sort of thing to the EU Green Deal, which has been the flagship of her last tenure of the European Commission. What she's saying now is we need to invest in green technology, that the investments need to go in rather than just focusing on climate neutrality. That's the shift. It's a small thing, but it's a big shift in thinking. And that plays really into the hands of those pro-business, pro-industry politicians of the sort of more liberal and centre-right factions in the European Parliament.
And von der Leyen also took aim at Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban over his one-man peace mission to end the war in Ukraine. How did that go down?
Yeah, I mean, the Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban plays a game where he fights with European Union officials, threatens vetoes, and then basically backs down because he knows his country needs the European Union's money. That's kind of how most observers and experts see it. But you're right, he's just taken over the rolling six-month council presidency. Orban decided that he would use this is what a lot of European politicians, including von der Leyen, have said, to make it look like he's in charge of the European Union at the moment. And he headed off to Moscow, shook hands with Vladimir Putin, the Russian president. Von der Leyen, in her speech, accused Orban of appeasement. He also went to Kyiv and to Beijing and to the United States to meet the presidential candidate Donald Trump before that assassination attempt. So everyone across the board, pretty much in the sort of mainstream of European politics, is unhappy with Viktor Orban. How they get on in the next 5 years, we'll have to wait and see.
DW's Brussels correspondent Jack Parrock there. Now, one of von der Leyen's priorities will be the issue of migration to Europe. The bloc continues to see large numbers of refugees arrive on its shores from Africa and the Middle East seeking asylum. Finland has just adopted a new law that might just include the EU's most restrictive measures against migration. The government in Helsinki says it has now given itself essential tools to deal with what it believes is a Russian effort to help people without valid asylum claims get to the Finnish border. Terry Schultz has more.
Helsinki accuses Moscow of using humans as hybrid warfare weapons. Now the Finnish parliament has handed the government the tool it called for in response, a so-called deportation law.
167 jaa-ääntä, 31 ei-ääntä.
By a vote of 167-31, the Finnish parliament approved the law last week. If the government should decide to enact it, for a period of 1 year, border guards would have the authority to send migrants back to Russia without the chance to claim asylum. It was prompted by the arrival of more than 1,300 migrants over the Russian border last year, which also led Finland to close all the crossing points. Finnish Prime Minister Petteri Orpo calls the measure a matter of national security for his country and for the European Union.
This law is in preparation for the situation that Finland might in future again become a target of hybrid influence through instrumentalized migration. I hope this law will never need to be used, but we are prepared. It is a strong message to Russia. It is a strong message to our allies. Finland takes care of its own security, and we ensure the security of the EU border.
But the increased protection against what Prime Minister Orpo believes is instrumentalized migration is controversial. The Finnish government itself acknowledges the new law conflicts with both EU and international laws, which ensure the right for those in need to ask for protection. And all 18 legal experts the Finnish parliament consulted advised that it clashes with Finland's own constitution. International law professor Martti Koskenniemi was one of those experts whose opinion was overruled by the Finnish parliament. He told DW News he's disappointed and worried.
We have prided ourselves of being for rule-based international order. If we start breaching this law, it becomes very easy for others to do that as well. But I'm more concerned of the presidential value of this in the Finnish internal politics. When we start breaching our own constitution, breaching the fundamental rights of migrants, foreigners and Finns, it becomes so much easier next time also to make exceptions to these very fundamental regulations.
However, in polls taken ahead of the parliamentary vote, almost two-thirds of Finnish citizens supported the deportation law. Joel Linnanmäki of the Finnish Institute of International Affairs says with Russian behavior becoming ever more unpredictable and menacing, the government felt it needed to do something.
It's the eternal Finnish dilemma between security and values of democracy and human rights. It's a very weird situation to be in. At the same time, I think a lot of Finns feel that we need to be strong against Russia and need to show that they can't target us and can't affect us. And that will be one way of, you know, trying to deter them.
Catherine Woolard, director of the European Council on Refugees and Exiles based in Brussels, is adamant that Finland is out of line with this law.
If somebody expresses the wish to apply for international protection, they have to have access to an asylum procedure. And that's the key element that is being removed by these measures. So in that respect, there is an obvious breach of EU law.
Woolard believes Finland and other EU governments which have enacted de facto border closures without changing their laws are actually playing into the Kremlin's hands with these measures and creating more insecurity, not less.
So the better way to manage the situation would to be have a calm and managed approach to refugees seeking protection. And that removes the power from these different states to try to manipulate people in order to gain advantage over European countries.
But despite experts emphasizing that Finland is breaking EU law, banning pushbacks of migrants, the European Commission seems to be willing to let the law slide. Commission President Ursula von der Leyen has publicly agreed with the Finnish government that this is a Kremlin-orchestrated hybrid threat. An EU spokesperson said the Commission will carefully analyze the Finnish law, but made clear that its priority is not to tolerate any instrumentalization of migrants. Terry Schultz, DW, Brussels.
Now, over the past 2.5 years, we've seen the devastation caused to Ukraine's infrastructure, cities and population by Russia's full-scale invasion. But restrictions imposed by Moscow when the war broke out have made reporting from inside Russia very difficult. A team of sociologists travelled at great personal risk to several Russian regions to conduct an undercover study to assess how the views of ordinary Russians to the conflict have changed over time. We're going to bring you our interview with researcher Natalia Savayeva from the Public Sociology Laboratory in St. Petersburg in two parts. In the first, I asked her to start by telling me about the initial reactions Russians had during the first weeks of the conflict.
The war, there was an event. It was a sort of a thing which people, they wanted to talk about it. So there was people who supported the war and supported Russia. There was more like, I'm a citizen of this country, that's my country, so maybe this war makes sense, right? And of course, there was people who were against the war. So people talked a lot about it. And a lot of friendship relationships and family relationships, they were just broken because people had very different views about what was happening.
And Natalia, your research has revisited these regions twice, most recently in autumn last year. So what had changed?
People actually stopped talking about it. In their everyday lives, in their everyday conversations, they live as if there was no war. People feel that it makes no sense to discuss the reasons of the war or even the future of this war, because at the beginning people really... I mean, they didn't want the war to prolong, right? They were really scared that this war will last. And now they realize that nobody knows when the war will be over, and it really scares a lot of people. So people prefer just not maybe to think too much about the war and just to accept it as a fact of their lives.
Now, we know that Putin built up a lot of support for his so-called special military operation domestically. There's also been a lot of anti-war feeling among ordinary Russians. How have things changed for them?
They found themselves in a situation when they actually have a lot of things in common with people who have different opinions about the war, but who also stayed and who also live in Russia. The struggles, the issues related or not related to the war. And at the same time, this distance between people who left and people who stayed, it is growing. So we see that there is like less and less understanding. So the people who left because of their anti-war views, I mean, they lose this feeling of understanding of what is going on in Russia. So this distance between people with anti-war views, even anti-war activists, while people who stayed in Russia, doesn't matter what kind of views they have, they kind of became more and more close to each other.
So it sounds as though if the war really divided people when it first began, people are now just getting on with their lives and some sort of unity has returned. Is that a fair assessment?
It's a unity of destiny in a way, right? But it's not a unity in terms of solidarity. So people who suffer because of the war, for example, who lose their relatives because they were killed, right? Or people who live in regions close to the border who are bombed, they find themselves isolated from the larger society. They realize that actually nobody understands them first, nobody cares about them second. We realize, they say, that we're just by ourselves. Yeah, it seems there is a war, but people in Russia live as if nothing was happening. And if we try to say something publicly or even privately to our friends or relatives about our problems, how we're worried about our loved ones, or how bad things are happening with them and we cannot help, nobody understands us because everybody lives in kind of like dream, right? So they try so hard to pretend that nothing is happening. They prefer to ignore all their complaints and all their regrets.
And let's talk about the economy now. Western sanctions on Russia in response to the war have so far had a limited impact on the economy. What did your team notice about people's attitudes to those sanctions and the impact on their own incomes?
Even those people who were at the beginning of the war said something like, sanctions wouldn't affect Russia, or like, oh, we would be fine. Those people, they actually were very scared. And then when after 2 years, the Russian economy was still fine, they became encouraged by that. There are also some groups of people who benefited from the war. Those are people who are occupied in everything related to war economy, production of war-related goods. But most of all, those are the people who benefited from the diminishing of market competition because of sanctions. A lot of companies, they left Russia. Many people who had marginalized position because it was just hard to compete for international companies or Western companies and services, they felt much better because now they're just the kings of the market and that's okay. They, the West, promised us that we would be crushed, and we are not crashed. Look at us right now. Some people live even better than we lived before. So maybe this war is not that bad. Maybe it's fine. Maybe it is justified.
I was talking there to Natalia Savelyeva, a researcher at the Public Sociology Laboratory. She's also a lecturer at University of Wisconsin, Madison. Still to come on Inside Europe, Serbia gives the go-ahead for a controversial mine to help meet Europe's demand for lithium to power electric vehicles. A reminder that DW keeps you updated on the latest news from across Europe. You can visit our website, dw.com, or check out DW Europe's social media pages. I'm Nick Martin in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. Meeting the demand for lithium is going to be a major challenge for Europe over the next decade as the switch to electric vehicles accelerates. So you might think that Serbia would be rejoicing over a plan to open Europe's largest lithium mine there. Lithium is, of course, a vital raw material for the batteries that power electric cars. Instead, the mine's causing conflict between the government and environmentalists, who say the ecological damage will far outweigh any economic gains. Our Balkans correspondent Guy Delaunay tells us more.
Protests against lithium mining in Serbia have started up again after a break of more than 2 years. For now, they're small-scale, focusing on the rural Jadar Valley. That's where the international mining giant Rio Tinto wants to develop Europe's first large-scale lithium extraction operation. They're planning to invest more than 2 billion euros. But these protesters view that as dirty money.
We have come to free ourselves. I believe that the groundwater will be contaminated. I don't need to listen to anyone, no scientist. None of the mining here is ecological, so this cannot be either.
I think this is the ultimate act of patriotism. Anyone who cares even a little about this country, let's set aside ideologies. Those who care about this land, the glorious heritage of our ancestors, the future of our children, the people, and life itself, are here today.
3 years ago, the protests were considerably larger and louder. Thousands of people blocked the roads into Serbia's capital, Belgrade, on multiple occasions. Not just environmental activists, but plenty of people who were new to protesting. All of them were alarmed that a foreign company had gained mining rights in a process they didn't understand, and they were concerned about the potential impact on important sources of food and water. With elections approaching, the government couldn't risk prolonged protests, so it cancelled Rio Tinto's permits. But now, with elections years down the line, the authorities have changed their tune. Ana Brnabic was prime minister when the ban was imposed. Now, as parliamentary speaker, she's convening a debate about the merits of lithium mining.
Dakle, ja mislim da je ovo šansa kakva se pruža.
I believe this is the chance offered to a country once in five centuries. For some countries, never. If we don't want it, fine. We will end up like all the other countries. We will be importers and won't have a value chain in Serbia. But if we want, we can all work together as a responsible country and society to take care of environmental protection and sustainability. We could ensure that the entire supply chain was in Serbia and make ourselves absolute monopolists for the European continent.
Opposition parties remain unconvinced. They never believed the lithium mine had been scrapped for good. Now they're demanding transparency if the Rio Tinto project is to be revived.
There is complete lack of trust in the government and basically every project that they are doing when they say that it will be in interest of citizens.
Biljana Djordjevic is the co-leader of the opposition Green Left movement.
Precisely because we don't have these strong institutions, we fear that Serbia will be in a way of sacrifice zone to extract lithium for electric vehicles that are important to European energy transition that nobody in Serbia pretty much can afford. People don't have any faith in these processes, and that they feel like every dialogue is in a way attempt to just legitimize something that has been already decided. I blame mostly government for this. If they had really wanted to have a proper dialogue, they could have done it in the past 2 years.
The arguments are likely to heat up. Last week, judges ruled that the ban on lithium mining was unconstitutional. That clears the way for Rio Tinto to resume work. Both the company and the government insist the mine will contribute to both Serbia's economy and Europe's energy security. But they've yet to convince environmentalists of the key issue, whether extracting the mineral crucial to sustainable transport can be done in an environmentally friendly fashion. Guy Delorne, DW, Belgrade.
And for more interesting stories from all over Europe, remember to subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Nick Martin in Germany.
is Inside Europe, and I'm Nick Martin in Germany. In the next half hour, Turkey's Erdogan is accused of hypocrisy over his opposition to Israel's war in Gaza.
Had there not been the economic crisis, probably they wouldn't be also so concerned about the trade with Israel. But the economic crisis somehow removed the rose-colored glasses of many people in Turkey.
What ordinary Russians think of accusations of Moscow's war crimes in Ukraine?
When they were answering a question about casualties, they just denied it. Like, Russian army doesn't kill civilians, and if there are any civilians killed, this is because Ukrainian army just bombs its own cities.
Could same-sex marriage be on the cards in Muslim-majority Kosovo? And their country needs them, but many Bulgarians are hesitant to enlist in the army despite a 30% pay hike.
Broadcasting from Germany, this is Inside Europe.
As the Israeli military continues its bombardment of Gaza, so does Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's rhetoric against Israel as he seeks to position himself at the forefront of international opposition. Despite such a stance, a Turkish port continues to be the main supplier of oil to Israel, and that is drawing growing anger in Turkey, which, as Dorian Jones reports, is putting Erdogan in a tight spot.
Campaigners calling for a trade boycott of Israel are targeting Azerbaijan's supply of oil there via the Turkish port of Ceyhan. The demonstrators pour red paint over the walls of the Istanbul headquarters of Soka, Azerbaijan's state energy company. And students at Istanbul's prestigious Galatasaray University have protested against a speech to be given by a senior soccer executive, accusing the company of having blood on its hands. Azerbaijan, a close ally of Israel, meets around 40% of the country's oil needs, a trade that has not been affected by Israel's war on Hamas. Galia Lindenstrauss is an analyst with the Institute for National Security Studies in Tel Aviv.
Till now, Azerbaijan has not stopped its oil exports to Israel. On the contrary, they're going as normal, and this is again a manifestation of the reliability of Azerbaijan and the fact that it is a true partner of Israel. I would even say that since Azerbaijan opened an embassy just a year ago in Israel, the trade relations have actually expanded. But again, most of the trade is surrounds the oil flowing from Azerbaijan to Israel through Turkey and the weapons acquisition Azerbaijan does in Israel.
But President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is paying a heavy price politically for facilitating the lucrative trade. Erdogan's AK party was hammered in March local elections, a defeat largely blamed on the Turkish-Israeli trade and an ongoing economic crisis. Sezin Öner is a commentator on Turkey's Politikyol news portal.
Had there not been the economic crisis, probably they wouldn't be also so concerned about the trade with Israel. But the economic crisis somehow removed the rose-colored glasses of many people in Turkey, including the AK Party supporters. So they started to see things as they are, and they started to criticize the government.
Dünya bir hastanın, bir manyağın, bir psikopatın.
Following his local election defeat, Erdogan imposed an Israeli trade embargo, boasting that Ankara was at the forefront of confronting Israel. But that embargo didn't include Azerbaijani oil exports via Turkey. Mehmet Erkutçu is the head of the London Energy Club, a grouping of government and energy sector leaders. He says given that Azerbaijan is Turkey's biggest investor, Erdogan cannot interfere with the Azeri-Israeli trade.
From what it looks, over the past few years, Azeri-Israeli relationship has been consolidated. It is a bulwark against Iran as well, in some regards. And therefore, Azeris, although I'm sure they are also unhappy with what's happening in Gaza as a result of the Israeli land forces attack, they would probably impress on Erdogan not to go that far to stop also this oil flow.
With protests against Azerbaijani oil exports to Israel continuing, police are now stepping up arrests against organizers, and that's prompting further protests. A woman whose son has been arrested demands to know why he's been detained simply for defending Palestine. Analysts say such displays of anger can only further undermine Erdogan's claims of being at the forefront of confronting Israel. Again, says in Erne of Politikyol News Portal.
The government said that they stopped the trade with Israel, but somehow it's continuing in other ways. So I think the real culprit, more so than the Azerbaijan companies or the Azerbaijan, it will be the government who's going to be held responsible for those protesting and for the conservative basis specifically.
Many protesters come from Erdogan's traditionally religious conservative base. And analysts warn that the ongoing oil trade with Israel could lead to more political pressure on the president. Dorian Jones, DW, Istanbul.
And from rising discontent with Erdogan to growing unease about Russia's war in Ukraine from ordinary Russians. Time for part two of our conversation with Russian sociologist Natalia Savelyeva, whose team travelled to several Russian regions three times during the first 18 months of the conflict. The researchers put themselves at risk of arrest in carrying out their work due to strict laws on anything seen as discrediting the Russian army or spreading what the Kremlin sees as anti-war messaging. The team have gained an incredible insight into how Russian attitudes are changing the longer the war goes on. We heard earlier how Russians are also experiencing war fatigue and how some are being impacted positively or negatively by international sanctions on Moscow. But in the second part of my chat, I asked Natalia what they're saying about the huge casualty rate on both sides.
What we notice is that the question about casualties among civilians, especially, but also among military people, that was one of the most sensitive. So, for example, those people whom we classified at the beginning as supporters of the war, so people who had justifications for the war, right? When they were answering a question about casualties, they just denied it. Like, Russian army doesn't kill civilians, or our soldiers, I just cannot believe that they do that because that's just our guys, our boys, they cannot do that. And if there are any civilians killed, this is because Ukrainian army just bombs its own cities. Or because, I mean, the war is like some civilians, of course, will suffer. But look at the United States, there was much worse in Iraq. And what those arguments have in common is basically denial, right? So now I would say that a lot of Russians, they stopped following news about the war. People now trust even less to any media, state media or oppositionist media. They don't want to follow the news about war that much.
And Natalia, your researchers were really able to get quite a unique insight just from listening to some of the gossip that is going around these regions. I'm talking about stories of widows spending the so-called grave money, that's the compensation given after their partners were killed in the war, on new cars, found new boyfriends, going on spending sprees.
Yeah, that's kind of, we saw it in different regions, that kind of gossips, and they use those gossips in order to prove different things, right? So sometimes they're talking about that in order to draw a boundaries between people who support their relatives who went to the war, who send something to them or who participate in different volunteering initiatives, and those women who don't follow this norm of a local community that you should just help other members of the community. That's a very interesting that those rumors, they in a way replaced discussions about losses and about death, right? So people talk more about those women who are spending the money of their husbands than discussions of how people are dying there, how horrible it is for local communities, and how this war is unfair.
Now, over the past 2.5 years, Russians have faced a lot more discrimination when travelling due to the war. Are ordinary Russians aware of the antipathy towards their country?
Yes, they are aware about it, and there was a lot of discussions. And of course, Russian media, official media, they try to amplify all the news about this antipathy. It doesn't matter what it is. Some restrictions about closing the borders, or there can be like discriminations based on language and things like that. Especially at the beginning of our study, what we saw is many people who before they claimed they had liberal views, so many of them said, so, well, we believe that Europe is such a civilized place and we always wanted like to travel to Europe, and we adored European art and European literature and everything. But now look at them, how horrible they behaved toward Russians, how they're like racist, how they discriminate Russians. So now we realize that Europe is actually a horrible place. They're very cynical and they cannot talk about any moral values here, and they cannot teach us how to live, and they cannot tell us anything about like our war and how horrible it is, because they're horrible themselves, right? So actually all those measures related to sanctions and to cases of discriminations, they worked in favor of supporting Putin and supporting war in a way that people used it as an additional argument, right? So the idea was like, okay, the whole world now is against us. We cannot travel. Everybody hates us. Everybody is very hostile to us. So yeah, okay, fine. We will be bad. But yeah, we will stay with our country. Whatever we'll do, you are bad too, right? Maybe our country is bad, but this is our bad country.
And how have attitudes changed as to who will win this war? Are Russians still confident that they will win?
When we asked it in 2022, people had in mind different scenarios about the end of the war. So in general, they had like more positive scenario when Russia wins, right? Russia wouldn't be disbanded. Russia wouldn't be sanctioned more. Russia wouldn't be forced to pay for reconstruction of Ukraine. Russia wouldn't be humiliated more. The scenario for the loss was that, like, okay, Russia lose the war, and then Russia will be humiliated. The war probably will continue within Russia in form of civil war. So maybe I don't like this war, but now we are in this situation of the war. We have to win, because if we lose, that will be horrible. That will be a nightmare. So what we saw in 2023 is that people stopped talking about any positive or negative scenarios of the war. So the only thing they wanted is for the war to be over. And some of them, they were more optimistic. They were like, so it will be over and everything will be fine. Some were like more like negative about that. But the major desire there was like, oh, whatever, it should be over. And the only thing that we want is to continue living as if nothing happened. Doesn't matter what like Russia will get in terms of lands. Really not many people care about those lands. Russia shouldn't pay for this war, and the best option here is if we will be able to continue live our lives as if like those last 2 years they just didn't happen.
That's interesting, isn't it? That people still believe that there will be no recrimination.
They hope for it. I think they desire it, right? So I don't know how much they believe. I think they want to believe that it is possible.
And then finally, Natalia, can you just explain to us about the difficulties that you had in conducting this research? Because I understand that Russian law is so strict now that you could have got into a lot of trouble for asking people the wrong questions.
Yeah, we were worried that somebody will report that we are doing something like that. I would say that the biggest problem there was talking about the war, actually, right? Because you could feel that you cannot just ask people openly and directly about the war, especially people whom you don't know well, right? They're very suspicious. People who have a positionist view, so they're scared sometimes that they will be reported. People who have pro-war, pro-Putin views, they also don't like to talk about the war. You always have to figure out some not direct ways to ask people about the war. Because, yeah, now Russian law, you can blame anyone for anything, basically, right? So, and you can easily say, oh, those people, they're collecting data which can be used against Russia, for example, right? And you can be arrested for that. Or discredit Russian army, you can be arrested for that. Yeah, unfortunately, that's just reality, like, for sociological studies in Russia now.
So you can see there why the research team had to do their study undercover. I was talking to Natalia Savilyeva, a researcher of the independent research group Public Sociology Lab and a lecturer at University of Wisconsin-Madison. And if you'd like to read the report, you can visit publicsociologylab.com/report3. The report is in Russian, but most browsers will give you a pretty good translation at the push of a button.
From Bonn, Germany, you're listening to Inside Europe.
Next, we head to Kosovo, which could become the first Muslim-majority country in the world to allow same-sex marriage. Back in April, the country's Prime Minister, Albin Kurti, announced plans to get a new civil code approved by Parliament, which would allow same-sex unions. That would be a momentous step in a region that is still quite conservative on this subject. Many believe that even if the legislation is passed, it probably won't make much of a difference to the discrimination faced by members of Kosovo's LGBTQ community, especially outside the capital, Pristina. Reporter Marilyn Costa went along to last month's Pride Week.
Major Matilda, the Daisy Supervision Skin, Kosovo, Happy Pride,
festive pride parade without incidents, a queer bar with drag shows and numerous art performances exploring LGBTQ identities. Pride Week in Kosovo's capital Pristina was a celebration of diversity. And for the second year, Prime Minister Albin Kurti walked alongside activists to show his support. In other Balkan countries, activities organized by the LGBTQ community are often accompanied by heavy security because of the threat of violence. But here in Pristina, the atmosphere seems different.
The next song is called Symbolism.
One of the artists who performed during Pride Week was Astrid Ismaili. Now based in Amsterdam, Ismaili says attitudes in Kosovo have changed a lot in recent years.
I moved out of Kosovo 9 years ago, and when I was living here, it was actually quite different and more difficult for queer people. And even now, of course, it's not as free, but it has changed quite a lot. And I'm impressed how quickly and how fast and how amazing the queer scene is becoming here.
And now Prime Minister Albin Kurti wants to take it a step further. In April, he said that he would personally ensure that a new civil code is approved by the parliament as soon as possible. This would allow same-sex unions. 2 years ago, a previous attempt to pass the legislation was voted down by MPs. This time round, Kurti seems to be optimistic it would be approved. But some activists from the LGBTQ community are cautious. For example, Medina Doughty. She's with Chica, a feminist NGO focused on improving minority rights.
Yesterday we published a TV debate from Chica, and the debate was about queer issues like gender and sexuality and queer rights overall in Kosovo. And today when we got into our office, we saw that someone vandalized our logo.
Kosovo seems to have two different faces when it comes to LGBTQ rights. When the country became independent, it adopted many laws based on those used in Western countries. Discrimination based on sexual orientation is not allowed. And since the right to marriage doesn't name any genders, there shouldn't be any obstacles. But Doughty says reality is different.
Kosovo is mainly a patriarchal society and its main values are outdated mindsets, which sadly we are a country in transition. I understand all the post-traumas and how we need still more time to continue to accept a more diverse society, but Kosovo isn't welcoming for queer people, and it's really homophobic and transphobic overall.
Some believe that Kuti is trying to implement same-sex unions as a symbol move to show the European Union how progressive he is, and to help Kosovo's bid to join the EU and the Council of Europe.
For me, as long as I don't see actions, the words don't mean anything. When he goes outside Kosovo, he promises something progressive and liberal, but inside Kosovo, he promises conservative things as well, too. So I think that these politics are really performative. Kurti has 51% of the parliament, and at least if he couldn't get the vote, at least he could have held accountable the deputies that spread all the homophobia towards the queer people.
But consensus within Kuti's party, Wetten van Dorsche, is not a given. There are leftist progressive members of parliament, but also some Islamic conservatives, who are against same-sex marriage. Ureysa Ahmeti from the Youth Initiative for Human Rights points to these conflicting values within the ruling party.
Kurti is making promises on, you know, the law is going to be, the draft civil code will be brought in the parliament again and will be voted yes. But then I wonder, is it really going to be voted yes? Because some of the most terrible statements we've heard, the most horrific hate language has been from MPs that are from the Dendulsia political party. So I don't know whether they're done a radical shift and mindset shift in their party, but I don't feel so hopeful so far.
Back in April, Kurti said the law would pass in May. That didn't happen, and it's unclear when the vote will take place. And the question is whether he will be able to get a majority of MPs on board before the elections that are scheduled in half a year.
We see these very significant steps from as governmental support, which we really appreciate and we feel are super important, that we have public support. We're going in the right direction, but I think we're not in the utopia that we want to be yet.
Marjolein Koster, DW, Pristina.
Still to come, the NATO members' army that's struggling to recruit more soldiers. And we'd love to hear your feedback on any of the reports or interviews you can hear. You can always drop a line to insideeurope@dw.com and we'll be back in touch. This is Inside Europe and I'm Nick Martin in Germany. Finally this week to Bulgaria, which has been marking the 20th anniversary of NATO membership. In two decades, its army still hasn't modernised in order to have an operational military that can be fully part of NATO missions. Its Air Force fleet is composed of Soviet-made MiG fighters that Alliance Systems recognise as enemy planes. Its naval forces are limited and the army is suffering from a severe personnel shortage. Damian Vodnarichirov has more.
The port city of Burgas is waking up on a hot summer day. Known mostly for being a major tourist destination in the summer, it has also been a logistic hub for the military since Ottoman times, going back a century and a half. Burgas is home to the logistic battalion of the Bulgarian army to this day. Soldiers gather to receive their orders and duties for the day, then head to the convoy. Lorries and all-terrain vehicles then thunder away to maneuver. The unit's duty is transporting troops, weapons, ammunition, and all sorts of supplies. Galina Daneshka is in charge of the unit's ambulance. She's been a soldier only for a couple of years, but she likes the way it's turning out.
I haven't been a soldier long, but I love this job. People here are really interesting, and the job itself is varied and our missions are diverse. Sometimes we need to patrol the border. Sometimes we're sent abroad. Sometimes we have to help first responders during a natural disaster.
Mm-hmm. After turning 36, Galina decided it was time for a career. Up until that point, she would work all kinds of small jobs. One day, her husband, an Air Force veteran, pointed her to an army recruitment campaign. Soon after enlisting, Galina saw firsthand the benefits of a career with the military.
I started out as an ambulance driver, but my superiors offered to send me to a military nurse course in Sofia. That's where I acquired a lot of my skills. Today, our unit will be doing driving drills, so I have to check everyone, measure their blood pressure, see if they have any kind of physical discomfort.
Bulgaria's army is in dire need of new recruits such as Galina. It has been struggling with lackluster enrollment for decades, ever since mandatory military service was waived in 2007.
Над площада прелитат бойни вертолети от отличното подразделение, където служи офицерът Григор Дамянов.
Under the communist regime, the Bulgarian army thrived. The country's strategic position facing two NATO members, Turkey and Greece, meant that it had to be able to respond to invading capitalist forces. The army's ranks included 150,000 soldiers. All branches, including the Air Force and mechanized infantry, had access to modern Soviet technology. The country's military might was displayed during parades in downtown Sofia, with tanks rolling down the streets and MiG fighters flying low over the crowds. Today, the army has less than 30,000 professional soldiers. About a fifth of all positions within the armed forces remain vacant. The logistic unit in Burgas is a bit more fortunate, however, says its commander, Lieutenant Colonel Lubomir Lutskanov.
About 7 to 8% of all positions in our unit are vacant, so we shouldn't complain, really. There are always a lot of people willing to sign up whenever a recruitment program is opened. This unit offers interesting working conditions, whether as social benefits or as career opportunities.
Funding, the Army's major problem, has also been steadily increasing over the past few years. A contract for new fighters and bombers has been signed with the United States, and new armored vehicles have also been commissioned. Soldiers' wages should also increase by 30% in 2025 to finally reach the average national salary of 1,100 euros per month. Demian Vodenicharov, DW Burgas.
Now, Inside Europe is just one of several podcasts produced by DW. Another that we want to get on your radar is all about the fascinating stories to be found in everyday objects. It's called Don't Drink the Milk, hosted by my colleague Rachel Stewart. The first season has 15 episodes if you want to binge listen this weekend. Season 2 is on the way, but here is a little taster.
Don't Drink the Milk. Weird name for a podcast, right? But it will all make sense, I promise. And no, it's not a podcast about milk. If you like historical intrigue, a bit of culture, and a sprinkling of controversy, this one's for you.
The arguments of homeopathy are based on, like, sand, and the sand was pouring through my fingers.
I'm Rachel Stewart, and for this new podcast from DW, I'm travelling around Europe, tracing the backstories of objects, ideas, and movements that you know well. But maybe you never really stop to think how these things got to you.
Condoms are known as French letters in the 19th century. Syphilis is the French disease, but in France it's the Italian disease.
Join us to follow the strange journeys of these everyday things and see how they change shape as they're exported through time and around the world, by force, by chance, or by choice. No need to pack your bags. Just subscribe to Don't Drink the Milk wherever you listen to podcasts.
Now, as well as our rebroadcasters around the world, Inside Europe continues to gain traction on podcast platforms, and you can help us to get even more listeners. Give us a review and hit the subscribe button, as it will help promote our show. This programme was produced by Helen Sini and sound engineer Christian Stater. And I'm Nick Martin. Thanks for listening. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Germany.